Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, June 29th, 2015. Our opening music today from the 1970s art rock band, Yes. And you hear the powerful bass line. That's Chris Squires. He passed away over the weekend. And Yes was a great band. I have fond memories of seeing them in concert and listening to their very adventurous, inventive music back in the day. And I chose this song, America, because I want to open today's podcast with something that you might find a little different. I'm a sharp critic of Barack Obama as president, and I haven't relaxed any of my objections to the surveillance state, the covert operations, the perpetual wars, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and many other issues that I have with this president. But I want to open today by focusing on the remarkable eulogy that he delivered Friday in Charleston, South Carolina, at the funeral of Reverend Mr. Pinckney, who is also a member of the state legislature in South Carolina. And I find it interesting because this occurred just hours after the historic Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, allowing many Americans to come out of a closet. And I believe that on Friday, Obama came out of his own closet, the race closet. Because what I saw and heard was an authentic black man delivering heartfelt, in some cases very pointed, remarks. And instead of dodging and timidly avoiding who he is, he embraced the fullness of the fact that he is our first black president. And I am still, you know, working through the memory of being in Denver at the end of August in 2008 when he gave his acceptance speech at the Democratic Convention. And it was, I believe, the 40th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. And Obama made veiled references to a reverend, but he couldn't bring himself to mention Martin Luther King at his own convention acceptance speech. And since then, while there have been moments where he's talked about race and acknowledged these issues, he has not provided leadership either for the African American community or for Americans in general on the thorny issues of race. Well, a lot of that changed on Friday, and I have some excerpts here from the president's speech. I'm linking to a video of the full speech that you can see at the New York Times website, and I strongly encourage you to watch this and to listen carefully to the president's words, because, as I say, I think they represent a dramatic break from the inhibitions that he has exhibited during his first 7 years as president.
For too long, we've been blind to the way past injustices continue to shape the present.
That's right.
Perhaps we see that now. Perhaps this tragedy causes us to ask some tough questions about how we can permit so many of our children to languish in poverty, or attend dilapidated schools, or grow up without prospects for a job or for career. Perhaps it causes us to examine what we're doing to cause some of our children to hate. Perhaps it softens hearts towards those lost young men, tens and tens of thousands caught up in the criminal justice system, and lead us to make sure that that system's not infected with bias, that we embrace changes in how we train and equip our police so that The bonds of trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve make us all safer and more secure. Maybe we now realize the way racial bias can infect us even when we don't realize it. So that we're guarding against not just racial slurs, but we're also guarding against this subtle impulse to call Johnny back for a job interview, but not Jamal. So that we search our hearts when we consider laws to make it harder for some of our fellow citizens to vote. By recognizing our common humanity, by treating every child as important, regardless of the color of their skin or the station into which they were born, and to do what's necessary to make opportunity real for every American. By doing that, we express God's grace.
As you may know, grace was a theme of the speech, and he began singing Amazing Grace at the end of his remarks.
For too long, we've been blind to the unique mayhem that gun violence inflicts upon this nation. Sporadically, our eyes are open. When eight of our brothers and sisters are cut down in a church basement, 12 in a movie theater, 26 in an elementary school. But I hope we also see the 30 precious lives cut short by gun violence in this country every single day. The countless more whose lives are forever changed. The survivors crippled. The children traumatized and fearful every day as they walk to school. The husband who will never feel his wife's warm touch. The entire communities whose grief overflows every time they have to watch what happened to them happen to some other place. The vast majority of Americans, the majority of gun owners, want to do something about this. We see that now. And I'm convinced that by acknowledging the pain and loss of others, even as we respect the traditions and ways of life that make up this beloved country, by making the moral choice to change, we express God's grace.
Amen.
We don't earn grace. We're all sinners. We don't deserve it. But God gives it to us anyway. And we choose how to receive it. It's our decision how to honor it. None of us can or should expect a transformation in race relations overnight. Every time something like this happens, somebody says, we have to have a conversation about race. We talk a lot about race. There's no shortcut. We don't need more talk.
Amen, Reverend Mr. Obama. We don't need more talk. I think this is a remarkable, very powerful speech where he took this opening from the tragic events in Charleston and widened out the focus to include black men in prison, our problem with police, voting rights, opportunity for people of color, and gun violence in this country. These are all subjects that have third rail potential. And Obama showed great courage, I think, and real leadership in articulating these problems at this time and in this place. And I see the outlines of Obama's post-presidential activities. I think he could become a true leader, not only of the black community, but of Americans committed to ending our sorry legacy of racial discrimination and hatred in this country. And so, yes, I will continue to criticize the president on many issues. But here, I really feel compelled to share with you my own reaction to this powerful speech, to the themes that he brought into it, in the cadence of a preacher, in the context of a black church. Not quite as fiery as the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, you might say, but channeling some of those same skills. And I want to acknowledge a 30-year-old woman from Charleston, North Carolina, named Bree Newsom. I'm sorry, she's from Charlotte, North Carolina, and she went to Charleston, South Carolina on Saturday. And she scaled the flagpole where the offensive Confederate flag was flying and, I believe, padlocked into position. And I have to say that it really touched me when I saw the video. It was all over Facebook on Saturday, of Bree Newsom defying the cops who came when they saw her halfway up the flagpole. She continued on her mission. She went up. She removed it. And she didn't throw it down or light it on fire or piss on it. Those are things I would have thought about. But she just held on to it, carried it down the flagpole with her, and politely submitted to arrest. And it's ugly that just a couple of hours later, the staff at the Capitol put it back up in time for a rally of 50 people who support keeping the flag flying there at the Capitol in South Carolina. One sobering note about the situation in the South: I have not seen this reported in the various news outlets that I monitor, but I found this from a friend's post on Facebook, and I believe it's reliable. There have been arsons at 5 black churches in the South just in the past 6 days. On June 21st in Knoxville, on the 23rd of June in Macon, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina on the 24th, Warrenville, South Carolina on the 26th, and the same day, a black church was set on fire in Tallahassee, Florida. We still have a lot of work to do. Well, the Supreme Court is trying to clear the decks so it can go on its summer vacation. It's an annual routine. And so there are several decisions released today, a couple of stinkers, but this good one. They issued a ruling that upholds Arizona's independent commission to select districts for both state and federal representatives. And this is a decision that has impact here in California because we are one of the few states free of gerrymandering because a few years ago we set up an independent redistricting commission. And this is a good government effort that I fully support. Many of my Democratic friends think that it's bad for the Democratic Party. But in fact, the party has benefited from lines being drawn by an independent commission instead of the politicians themselves. So this is a real victory. And the virus of independent redistricting is something that we need to spread to other states, and pronto, because it is the basis for the Republican control of the House of Representatives today. They would not control it if they didn't have control over redistricting at the state level. And now to the stinkers, the legal turds that were released by the Supreme Court today. In one, they struck down new rules for the biggest polluters in the country, coal-fired power plants. A few years ago, the EPA introduced new rules regulating the effluents from coal-fired power plants, and they put on restrictions. And it's interesting because the industry has largely complied. That didn't get in the way of a decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia, ruling that the EPA had not reasonably considered the cost factor when drafting the air pollution regulations. And this is really annoying because the court has said that the Environmental Protection Act that created the EPA does authorize it to regulate emissions of this sort. But finding a kind of a loophole or just a little gotcha factor in the law, Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion overturning the rule, saying that the EPA had not properly evaluated the costs. And it appears that they simply didn't do them at the stage of the process that the court, or at least this ruling, suggests should have been followed. So it's annoying because it shows that the justices value corporate profits over the environment and the pollution that is spewed from these power plants every day, even with the reduction in emissions that many of them have adhered to. So it's frustrating that the majority of the court doesn't really see that pollution, environmental degradation, climate change are all linked, and that these are things that we cannot continue to just avoid and push into the future. The other ruling that came out of the court, this one written by Justice Sam Alito, one of the Catholics who wrung his hands last week over the marriage equality ruling, claiming that Catholics and other religious people will now become victims of bigotry by those who have the right to marry. As I said on Friday, it displays his deep homophobia and not much more. Well, today, Justice Alito signed this ruling that he wrote that conflicts with the fundamental teachings of the Catholic Church that he says he embraces, because he not only ruled in a manner that reinstates the execution of those convicted of capital crimes across the nation, but he basically just batted away concerns about the use of drugs that we saw last year botch executions in Ohio and Oklahoma. And this gets into the pharmacology of how you kill people with a lethal injection. And Justice Alito is not concerned that it took one guy more than 45 minutes writhing in pain and agony to die, because these people tend to embrace a kind of biblical sense of justice. That it doesn't matter when the state executes someone because they were convicted of a gruesome crime, it's okay to inflict inhumane punishments on them. Now, this is in clear violation of the Eighth Amendment, but that doesn't bother people like Justice Alito. And in a real red herring defense, he said that the inmates who challenged the use of lethal injections that caused these agonizing results had failed to identify an available and preferable method. Now, this is just complete bullshit, legally speaking, because it is not the burden of people who challenge something that is cruel and unusual, a violation of the Eighth Amendment, to come up with a solution that complies with the Eighth Amendment. That is just ridiculous. And in the dissenting opinion, Justice Sonia Sotomayor noted that. Petitioners contend Oklahoma's current protocol is a barbarous method of punishment, the chemical equivalent of being burned alive. But under the court's new rule, it would not matter whether the state intended to use midazolam or instead to have petitioners drawn and quartered, slowly tortured to death, or actually burned at the stake. Good for you, Sonia. And also, Justice Breyer, joined in his dissent by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, raised the bigger question that the Republican conservatives on the court won't touch. Breyer wrote, "Rather than try to patch up the death penalty's legal wounds one at a time, I would ask for full briefing on a more basic question: whether the death penalty violates the Constitution. I hope the justices will visit that sooner than later. Well, the reaction to the gay marriage ruling issued on Friday is predictable and extreme. We have candidates for the Republican nomination for president, like the Reverend Mike Huckabee, saying that the Supreme Court tried to unwrite the laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, and suggesting that civil disobedience is in order. Now, this is rich, coming from these people who dismiss any kind of progressive expression of civil disobedience or that kind of dissent. We also have people like Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, another wannabe presidential contender, who said, maybe partially joking, but he said it anyway, that the answer is to defund the Supreme Court. Wow, that'll fix it. And as if that's constitutional. Rick Perry derided the ruling, but didn't suggest a next step. Carly Fiorina said the opponents of the ruling should now focus efforts on religious freedom and public accommodation, such as all those bakers who don't want to make cakes for gay weddings. Yeah, that's a really important issue. Scott Walker wants to trot out a constitutional amendment to undo the marriage ruling, and Rick Santorum just kind of blathered on. Today I released an in-depth interview for our subscribers at peterbcollins.com with a man who I do consider a personal hero, Randy Hayes. He founded the Rainforest Action Network. He now heads Foundation Earth. And he has authored a letter that is being widely signed, aimed at those who will meet in Turkey later this year at the G20 summit. And you can hear that discussion in our interview today. I also talked to Randy Hayes about the Pope and his encyclical on climate change, about how Obama's words don't match the actions, about how the Keystone XL pipeline is a failure as the rallying point for those concerned about climate change and global warming in this country. It's quite a conversation. Here's an excerpt from my interview with Randy Hayes.
There are ways in which we could, you know, move towards full employment. It's a kind of World War II mobilization sort of effort that I'm thinking of here. It does require a lot of government coordination in an era when big government has been demonized very effectively, not always for the most stellar reasons either. The question to me is not really about big government. It's more like, what are the legitimate functions of public governance? And then let's fund them to do a thoroughly competent job in those categories, right? So it's not a question of big or small government. That's the false question. The real question is, what do we want and need from public governance, and how do we put the public back into governance, and then how do we structure that economic model?
Mm-hmm.
Our letter actually goes into, you know, three major aspects of that economic model shift, and it really has to do with honoring nature's carrying capacity and analyzing how to stay underneath the overshoot situations, like we have overshot greenhouse gases. It has to do with a true cost economy. How do you internalize those externalities? The cleanest things should be the cheapest. I mean, a toxic tomato ought to cost more than an organic tomato.
You can hear the full interview with Randy Hayes. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, anywhere you can get the Peter B. Collins podcast. And as you know, I am very grateful to people who support my work here. And over the weekend, I went to my P.O. box. It's been a while since I stopped there. And I got two heartwarming letters. One from the longest, most loyal subscriber to this podcast, Paul L. Sesser, who lives in Northern California. And I've mentioned him from time to time because the first of every month I can count on it. He has mailed a check, and for the last few years, he has been contributing at the rate of $20 a month. and I got a note from him with his most recent check. Therefore, I am increasing my monthly donation to $40 since I can afford it to help pay for your great work. Thanks for what you're doing. Paul, you really made my day, and thank you for your generosity and your recognition of what I do here. And then there's a guy who uses the nom de guerre Max LOLs. And he comes from the Northwest, somewhere around Seattle. And he tipped me off last week by email that I should go to the P.O. box because there was something there to renew his subscription for the next 2 years. So I opened this envelope, and Max put on the outside that it was from Max and a return address, but on the inside there is no note. There were two items. One was a crumpled-up Post-it note on one side of a piece of paper, and the other was a $100 bill that had been folded and then crumpled and then stomped on and is attached somehow to this piece of paper in the letter. It is the most unusual payment. No, it's not. I got those coffee beans from Russ in in Kona. But I thank every one of you for being generous, resourceful in how you decide to pay. And I know some people don't like to use PayPal, I understand. You can always send a check or a crumpled up $100 bill, we accept that, to Box 100, Mill Valley, California, and the zip code is 94942. And you know the spiel, right? If you want to subscribe, go to peterbcollins.com, sign up links under my picture, you choose on the next page, and the best deal is the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get my bonus gift, the ebook edition of Pepe Escobar's Empire of Chaos. Well, there's a lot more news here, and I'll move quickly because I'm reaching my self-imposed time limit here. But today, a bank holiday for the entire week was declared in Greece, and the stock market was shut down as they brace for the uncertain outcome of the brinksmanship talks with the European bankers. And I was surprised, like everyone, at the move by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras on Saturday when he announced that there will be an instant referendum coming up on Sunday, July 5th. And that he is basically going to seek the will of Greek voters and then follow their guidance. And I am rooting for Tsipras here. When you look at the numbers, the banksters from Europe want Greeks to accept the next bailout installment so that they can immediately pay almost $2 billion to the same bankers who are advancing them that money. And with it comes humiliation, the destabilization of the Greek economy, the dismantling of public facilities that will be sold off to for-profit enterprises. And I'm with the Greek citizens and with the Tsipras government. The bankers can always work out a way to get their money. We know that they will get their money in the end. But it is ridiculous for them to try to squeeze blood out of this turnip, to try to extract their pounds of flesh from the Greeks who simply don't have it to deliver. And so we have these predatory lenders from Europe who are going to impose their will on the people of Greece, regardless of the consequences. Over the weekend, the latest Gaza Freedom Flotilla sailed from multiple locations toward Gaza, and the lead ship, the Marianne, was intercepted in international waters once again by the Israeli Navy. And this is a clear violation of international law, but the Israelis don't care. The other three boats, part of the flotilla, turned back and evaded the being detained by the Israeli Navy. Naval officials say they advised the crew to change course several times, and after they refused, naval forces climbed on board and searched the vessel in international waters. Now, the Israeli military is admitting that they conducted this illegal stop in international waters and then took the boat toward the Israeli port of Ashdod. And as you may have heard, Bibi Netanyahu said he was going to rock the boat on this one. And he fulminated in true deceptive form, quote, if you're really concerned about human rights, you would not be sailing in support of a terrorist regime which summarily executes citizens in the Gaza Strip and uses children as human shields. I mean, it's so perverse to hear him lie this way. Because the human shields charge is an excuse for all the children that Israel killed in the assault on Gaza last summer. And they are not sailing in support of the Hamas government. They are sailing in support of fishermen in Gaza. The plan was to donate the Marianne, this fishing boat, to Palestinian fishermen. And the boat was carefully examined. One of the other boats, the protesters reported, was sabotaged. And so the conflict goes on. I believe that our friend Colonel Ann Wright was on the Marianne, and I'll attempt to reach her over the next few days and see if we can get her first-person account. Meanwhile, over the weekend, actually it happened on Friday, the Vatican signed a treaty with the state of Palestine, trying to set an example for the rest of the world not to submit to Israel's madness. Now we have our own little Greek debt problem offshore of the United States in the U.S. possession, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is drowning with $72 billion in debt, and the governor, Alejandro Garcia Padilla, announced that the debt is not payable. They do not have the money. And the problems are compounded because under the law, as a commonwealth, a possession of the United States, Puerto Rico is not allowed to use the bankruptcy laws. And about $25 billion of this $72 billion in debt is related to public corporations, probably a power company, entities like that. And Puerto Rico is trying to get Congress to change the law so at least those public corporations could file for bankruptcy. And Governor Garcia Padilla is going to give a speech to the people of Puerto Rico tonight to try to sort out what's next. And finally today, John Kerry is back in Vienna. The talks with the P5 plus one and Iran have been extended vaguely for a few days. It appears that Ayatollah Khamenei is kind of waffling and confusing the negotiators there. And the inside scoop is they appear to be making a little progress on some issues, but it's still anybody's guess whether they will be able to work out a deal. The drop-dead deadline under the bill that Obama signed, being, you know, when his hand was forced by the Republican Congress, is July 9th. So we'll see how long it takes to get a deal or to see the talks break off. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.